Welcome to the AKC Podcast, an audio resource for the King's community following the Associateship of King's College programme. The AKC is an inclusive, research-led programme of lectures which explore diverse religious and cultural perspectives. For more information, visit kcl.ac.uk/AKC. Lecture resources and further reading links for this lecture are available on the AKC Keats area.
Hello everyone, and thank you very much to Karen and the King for the invitation to come and speak about topics that I'm working on, I'm interested in, and I'm still working on and trying to arrive at a fuller theory of. So it gives me a chance to use you all today as kind of guinea pigs for advancing on ideas I've had about the way people see the nature of humans and our lives and what it is to be a conscious mind in the world. How to develop a fuller theory out of the pictures that we've seen already of how that works out in ancient philosophy and philosophy across the world. So you're helping me to kind of build a complete model, which is still very much a work in progress. So suggestions will be welcome. What I want to talk about today is the idea that every culture has a way of seeing what it is to be a person, a mind, a self in the world. What are our possibilities for action and interaction, for thinking and living? I think often in the West, we don't bring out the way in which we use an implicit concept of what a person and a life and a mind is. There's a tendency, I think, at least when I grew up, to be told that you simply are, and you have a personality. Here you are in it. Off you go and use the person that you happen to be. And I don't think I was really taught as a child that we have the possibility of changing, shifting, curating the person that we are. Right? It's a sense of growing up and developing and thinking about yourself a bit. But the sense that we really get to make ourselves was not as strong for me as it might have been, and as I think it is in some other cultures. Part of what's interesting about the Indian conception of the self, and of course there's many different conceptions, but I think there's an overarching picture of the self as something that we get to change, reshape, and then proceed in. And so I'm going to be exploring the idea that the self is a kind of a malleable machine. Our bodies, our minds, our emotions, our desires, our habits, our personality even, is something changeable. And if you don't like the one you're in, if you don't like the mind and the personality you're in, you get to change it, right? But of course, it's not automatically easy to do. We need a sort of a manual. We need to understand the mechanism of the self. We need to understand its functioning and processes and systems. And we need to become good mechanics so that we can do the work to take apart the bits of the self, recalibrate them, and become someone new who we'd prefer to be. So I'm going to talk about that idea today, and I think I want to look at it as something that India is particularly good at bringing out. It's there in Plato, it's there in other traditions, but I think India has a particular interest in the art of making yourself. So I'm going to use the idea of yoga, but I'm going to use the word yoga in the largest sense of that word. In the West, it's very common for people to think of yoga as a physical practice that you do that may have meditative elements, but mainly is about making yourself healthy. Right? But I'm going to be using it in a different and older Indian sense that's linked to its kind of etymological basis. The idea of yuj, of yukta in Sanskrit, of yoking. And yoga and yoke are words that are cognate in the two languages, of yoking, of harnessing and controlling oneself. So here, yoga is a kind of an art of control, an art of guidance, an art of steering, and that is usually applied specifically to the self, to your own mind and feelings. So we're looking at Indian yogas in the plural and the art of self-construction. And the idea is that India is kind of a culture directed toward the self more than many others are. It's interesting, of course, there's a huge area of study on the notion of the soul in Western history, the soul in Plato, the soul in Old Testament sources, the soul in other ancient Near Eastern cultures. But sometimes you feel as if the soul is kind of a given, that there is a being that you are. And I think what I see in India is, from the very early stage, interrogation of what we are, a question of what we are, which makes us think, huh, we are a mystery to ourselves. That idea that maybe Freud employs 2,000 years later, that we don't understand ourselves well, and that there are levels of the self and forces within the self that we don't always recognize, is something that I think India gets 2,000 years earlier, around the time of the Upanishads and of the Buddha, something like 500, 400, 300 BC. And because they have this 2,000-year head start, you see a lot of different arts and sciences and theories of selfhood coming up. So the idea is that India offers models, methods, and exemplars for developing a better self than the one you might happen to find yourself in. Now, comparatively, if we kind of try and draw a comparison across different cultures and their concepts of the self, you see many different models of what we are, what the person is, what a mind is, across cultures. One is the Platonic self, arguably in the West, in European culture, which has this kind of curious relationship with ancient Greece. You get Germans thinking themselves as basically Greeks in their mind. You know, whether that's correct or not is complicated. But the idea that Plato becomes what is taken up and turned into the Western self is very important. So that we see this tripartite Platonic self, basically kind of passions, and then the mind who can kind of direct the passions. We see that coming up again and again. Indeed, it influences Schopenhauer, it influences Freud, it influences classics, classic philosophers, Descartes, etc. So in some ways, European culture inherits the Platonic self. And later it inherits the Cartesian self, that I'm in here, in my head, looking out at the world, as if spectating into a theater. And that model becomes hugely influential as well. And it influences the way we think about philosophy of mind, psychology today. People have tried to bring new theories to bear, like the open body, the idea that actually we interact with the world in much richer and more complicated ways than we thought. And in India, we also have models of the self. But I sometimes think that because in India there's not one model, but a number, there is a complicated picture where people don't think of it necessarily as there being a single Indian conception that we come up with. Partly because India has this huge debate that took place. On the one hand, Hindus said there's a core self. On the other hand, Buddhists said there's no self. So you have one picture in India from very early stage, at least 300 BC, of a glowing immortal soul within ourselves that we must find from the Hindu camp. And on the other side, from the Buddhist camp, you've got the idea that if you dig down and peel away the wrapping of your psyche and personality and so on, you'll get to a space. There is no core self in classic, especially early Buddhist texts. So you've got like immortal light versus empty space models kind of striving against each other in India for a long, long, long period, which means there isn't a single model that we can go to. But people have been interested to try and work out what's going on in there. So there's the Platonic self, rational spirit and appetite. And people have tried to draw comparison between these different traditions. Usually, if you look at India, people tend to see it as emphasizing the idea of a core, immortal, and immovable self, a soul that is divine. It's India's most famous and widely exported idea, I think. So that it's very much something people see as at the core of kind of yogic practice. If you calm, if you slow, you can find the core, immortal, immovable self. It's something that infiltrates kind of Western philosophy through Schopenhauer and those to whom he passed on his ideas, Nietzsche, etc., etc. He has a huge influence on German and British idealism. And it's something that India actually helped to kind of promote as one of the great gifts of Indian culture, this idea of an absolutely immortal and divine core self. So people like Swami Vivekananda, who came to Europe, to Chicago in the Parliament of World Religions at the beginning of the 1900s, and said, here is what we can give you. One of the things we can give is a sense of a true eternal self in all beings, which he linked to human rights and all kinds of other issues. And that's an important idea. But actually, there are diverse Indian theories of self at work. Matthew Robertson, in his book Purusha, has talked about this, that it's much more a self that interacts and opens up to different features of the world, physical, mental, social, etc. Janardhan Guneri has said, actually, there's a concealed art of the self, taking apart, getting past your psyche and feelings to get your hands kind of into the mechanism of your own mind, and then be able to manipulate it, to do good things with it, to dissolve, break apart, interchange minds, focus your mind, intensify your mind, create a new version of yourself, or expand the one you have. I think India is very sensitive to the idea that most of the time we feel ourselves in a small space, just what we can visually see and hear, and we feel ourselves caught within a small time, the present moment. But actually, the mind has a huge range beyond what we see and hear in the present moment. So there's also issues of expanding the mind that we see in play. And indeed, again, scholars have written about this. Frederick Smith's wonderful book, The Self-Possessed, talks about possession. And he starts with The Exorcist, the horror movie, and the idea that having your mind be possessed by someone else, in the West, it seems awful. But in India, and actually many Southeast Asian cultures as well, possession is sometimes a good thing. You can go into someone's mind or invite someone in. Love is a kind of possession. Divine, being possessed by the divine, can be something good. So it's very different ways of thinking about what the self can be and what its boundaries should be, and whether you need to hide within your Cartesian theater or connect with other people in a positive way. The Buddhist self, emotion and devotion and embodiment, and rasa is a certain kind of emotional theory that we'll talk about. So that people start to realize that in line with the kind of philosophy that was brought forward by Pierre Hadot in his famous seminal book, Philosophy as a Way of Life, where he talked about the ancient Greek philosophies, Plato included, not just as philosophy, but as ways of shaping and forming yourself. And the famous work by Michel Foucault, Technologies of the Self, where he analyzes how different cultures quietly shape you, but also give you means, if you look for them, to shape yourself, maybe therefore resisting some of the forces that your culture may impose on you, then there's a whole area of thought there that looks at self-cultivation, and that's the book that we were talking about, where in some ways I tried to bring that out in the Indian context. There are technologies and arts of the self that we can draw upon. Yoga, which is harnessing and controlling, Samyoga, which is putting together oneself. And in the book Self-Cultivation Philosophies, Christopher Gowan reminds us of the personal significance of this. He says, could philosophical reflection play a significant role in improving our lives? My grandmother in America, God bless her, she thinks that philosophy is really pretty useless. And I think she'd be much more proud of me if I'd done something else. But and I just say, no, Granny, it's really relevant. She kind of looks at me skeptically. And it's a good reminder to kind of stay in touch with things. But in some ways, I want to say what Christopher Gowan says, it plays a role in improving our lives. Could seeking to understand fundamental questions about ourselves help us ease our anxieties, alleviate our frustrations, transform our desires, expand our moral concerns, and enlarge our hopes? Now, often, in a way, though, what I want to do is challenge the way people usually look at that in the Indian context. Often people see these cultivation philosophies as based on what we might call a Stoic model. The main problem is anxiety, fear, and the main thing we need to do is learn to calm ourselves by distancing ourselves. Right? This is a philosophy you see quite commonly in India, and you see it in the Stoics in sort of the ancient European world as well, and it's kind of pushing back to that. Now, some of us, however, have said, yeah, but India also is interested in connecting with the world. It's interested in also kind of developing a new body and also kind of like a mental body, like a personality for ourselves, so reconstructing. And it's also sometimes, which my first book was about, it's interested in intensifying yourself. Don't become more calm and distant, become more engaged and alive. Right? So that it's not one model necessarily that dominates the Indian picture. So if knowledge isn't just philosophy, it's also self-cultivation. We can go back, and I think India for a long time has this fascination with the uses of knowledge for the self. The Atharva Veda is a very, very old text, and it's hard to date this particular bit, but it may be something like 800 BC. And in the Atharva Veda, there's a wonderful hymn in which the poet writing this writes, amidst praise for the gods, but also reflection on the nature of the human. He says, "What a thing I am, I know not clearly. Mysterious, bound up, I wander in the mind." All right, so a little existential statement of a sense of questioning about the self. And, I don't know, 500 years or so later, you get the Katha Upanishad, which gets quoted in the Bhagavad Gita, and later texts, it's read by many, many people in the Western world, gives its analysis of the self. Know the self as the rider in a chariot, and the body as simply the chariot. The intellect is the charioteer, the mind are the reins, the senses are the horses that pull you along, and the sense objects, the world, is the path that you're negotiating in this chariot of the self. He who's linked, yoga, yuj, harnesses the body, senses, mind, the wise proclaim as the one who enjoys. Right? And enjoy here is a complicated word to translate. But notice it isn't just saying the one who can become free from suffering. This is a text influenced by Buddhism and Stoic ideas. It doesn't say it's about, it says you get to enjoy whatever it is that you want to direct yourself to. So people, there is a tradition within Indian thought that is somewhat reductive of the self. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It seeks to dissolve or disassemble the mind or distance from personality, where we deconstruct our concept of self in Buddhism or purify consciousness in classical yoga or strip back to the soul in Vedanta. Right? So there's lots that it wants to strip down, reduce personality, distance from world. But I want to bring out texts where we see something that can also be constructive. So that Ayurveda, for instance, which is ancient Indian sort of medicine, effectively, it's a medical science. Ayurveda has a chapter on the body and the self called the Sharira, Sanskrit that means body, the Sharira Stana, the body chapter, where it analyzes the self. And it talks about what it means to take the different parts of your mind and body and lifestyle and put them together to construct a healthy, balanced, functional self. Doesn't tell you what to function it for. You may want to become a politician, you may want to become an artist, you may want to become a father or mother, you may want to become an ascetic. What matters is that you have the art of reconstruction. And there are all kinds of examples of this that we'll look at now. So in philosophy, in possession, in ethics, in devotional traditions religiously, in aesthetics. We see different uses of this science of reconstructing the self. And so our overarching research question is partly this: what can texts tell you about the kinds of ideas people had about the self and its possibilities in that era? We're looking at kind of classical India, what we might call the Indian imaginaire of the self, the imaginaire being all the ideas that were prevalent at the time. So now we have an imaginaire of, for instance, I don't know, therapy and the self-seeking health. Maybe in the past, in the Enlightenment, you had an imaginaire of the rational self working out truth in a rational way. In India, we have imaginaires, but what are they? And also, we can keep in the back of our mind a social question. To what extent were these options really open to people? Yoga was always, to some extent, a slightly elite practice, just because most people didn't have time to do it. Now it's being, in a way, incorporated into the populace much more widely. But to what extent were these options open to individuals? To what extent were they closed off according to the context socially, or the idea that you only get to do it if you have a certain identity as your pre-existing setting? Right? In a way, yoga existed in a dialectic with Dharma. Yoga is the ability to understand, analyze, and take control of yourself. Dharma is the idea that there are certain things you should do. So actually, Mircea Eliade, who was a great sort of scholar of religions, complicated but great scholar of religions, he said yoga is really about freedom, and dharma is about duty. So we see a dialectic in each of our lives between your identity and the role and your duty and the freedom that you could grasp onto if you take hold of these sort of arts of the self. And arguably, India has different exemplars of people who do kind of take hold of themselves, as it were, are able to decide who they want to be and activate that freedom and autonomy, from the sort of ancient sages and rishis to yogis, tantric yogis, who are about powers, or ascetic yogis, who are about tearing down the self. Up there, Mirabai, who uses these kind of arts to focus on love of God. Or someone like Sulabha, who I think Ramprasad Chakravarti talked about, who is a female yogi who decides she's not in any particular tradition, she's going to learn these arts to make herself strong, rational, able, and cultivate herself into the person she wants to be. So you get examples of people who are using these arts for their own purposes. And all of it fits into a picture of selfhood. So Carol Werner in 1978 wrote, "Man in the Vedic, the ancient Indian understanding, is a complex being. His personality is a structural unity of dynamic forces or elements which are themselves impersonal and universal by nature." So think of a sculpture or a kind of a machine of many forces and elements that have to work in connection. But there are no blind mechanical or physical forces. Rather, what we are possess an inherent intelligence of different grades of intelligence. Not just one mind we have. There's the subconscious, there's reason, there's feeling, there's kind of the part of you that reasons about your own reasoning. So there's different grades, which leads them to the formation of functional units. My rational side, my emotional side, this part of my personality, that part, with inner hierarchical structures on both cosmic and individual levels. Thus, cosmos emerges out of chaos, and individual beings out of the interplay of cosmic forces. What a human body and mind is a strange cluster, like a little storm, a little contained storm of many forces that come together and should be a chaos. But actually, mind is the creature, is the force, if you like, that brings them together into an organized way and allows them to take a direction of their own and move forward through life. And you see this, there was an ideal in the ancient Vedic world. So now we're looking at the earliest Indian texts, and this is from the Atharva Veda. There's an ideal of a person who has managed to gain that kind of control. Ironically, the ideal that we see here was of a student, a brahmacharya. And of course, students back then were all teetotal, celibate, extremely ascetic characters. Not necessarily how we think of students in the modern British consciousness, but let's go with that. And these kind of very focused, very dedicated, in a way, lives that were very kind of contracted and focused on study. This person becomes an ideal, almost of like a wizard-like person who can rule the universe through the skills they acquire. The brahmacharan is the word for a student effectively here. The brahmacharan moves, impelling both hemispheres of the world. In him, the gods, which here can also mean elements and forces, are harmonized. He holds the heavens and the earth. He fills the teacher with power. Oh, thank you, students. The ancestors, the divine spirits, and all the gods each follow the student. The spirits follow after him, 6,333 of them. He fills the gods with power, with energy. This person clothes himself in the womb of the earth, clothes himself in heaven and in the atmosphere. By knowing all that you know, whether you're a physics student, or a sociology student, or philosophy student, you are clothed in that knowledge. It becomes a kind of a body that you wear. This person at the station of the sun did attain unto the worlds of light. They depicted the student as someone who can access many worlds while the rest of us are stuck within only one. Now I'm going to go through a couple of texts that I think develop these ideas here and try and see where they take us. And if at the end of it we get a model of the self, like a mechanical model of how the car works, as it were, of how the self machine works. So if you've got that ideal of what we can become, how does that work? The Upanishads are ancient texts, something like between 800 and 300 BC, talks about the self as bipartite. There's an ancient text that says, two birds who are companions and friends nestle on the very same tree. One of them eats a tasty fig, the other one, not eating, looks on. Sounds like just a weird bit of poetry, but it's talking about the mind, about the self. In our mind, the tree is the body. In our mind, there are two birds, not one. One is eating the tasty fig of life, perception, the world, and awareness. I get up, I go, oh, I want some coffee and some orange juice, and I eat that tasty fig. I think I've got to write a lecture today, and I do that. That mind is always engaging and creating and imbibing the world. But it reminds us that there's another part of each mind which is watching yourself do that, right? You can notice it in yourself. I'm like, oh, I'm really stressed right now. Oh, I'm doing really well right now. Oh, I'm quite tired right now. Oh, I must remember to do this later, right? So there's a bipartite mind, one who's engaged and one who's watching. And one of them is the self whose desires and intentions, if they get control of them, can become real. So maybe the bird self is the one who usually decides what I do. Oh, I really got off the train station. I thought, yeah, there's pret à manger. I really want a tuna sandwich. And part of my mind thought, I don't need a tuna sandwich. Why do you want a tuna sandwich? But the fig-eating part of my mind went and got the tuna sandwich and ate it. Well, the other part thought, what was that for? I don't know. Right. So that sense of two parts is there. The idea is that the desires and intentions that we most sincerely value in ourselves should become the real ones and not the others, so that we have greater freedom, as it were. And the idea is that if you can take hold of your mind, your imagination, and your senses, this will be a good thing. So you've got the kind of notions that in early texts like the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which this is taken from, when you go into sleep and into dreams, that's your mind doing strange, creative new things. When we're awake in the world, we're receiving the world. You know, if I want to walk across the stage, I have to negotiate the actual physical reality. But the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is very old, it's like 800, at least 800 BC, they look at dreams and they say, sometimes we make reality. We have a massive creative capacity within our minds that comes out every night and that we don't even use most of the time, right? So between the passive world-receiving self and the creative world-making self, there are two very different sides, right? And it talks about that self, and so down there it says, just as a great king taking his people with him may move around in his domain at will, so the core self, taking the vital functions of the mind with him, moves around his body at will. And that, in a way, I think also refers to what's sometimes called interoception. I can take my mind and direct it to my toe. I can feel, you can do it right now, feel what your toe's feeling. Then I can direct my mind to my fingers, and your mind will go over there. I can direct my mind to memories of yesterday, and then to what I hope will happen next week, and to different sides of myself. That ability to move within the self is really important, right? It likens it almost to, one text says it's like a spider who builds a web and then is able to travel to different parts of itself. We are the web, and we're able to move around within ourselves. And there are lots of texts in the Upanishads that affirm that ability to a high degree. Whatever world a man whose being is purified, focused, ponders with his mind, whatever desires he covets, whatever desires you hold most clear, that very world that you think of, those very desires that you focus on, you win. So it wants to remind you that if you focus on certain kinds of things, they'll become the ones that your whole being is directed to and that you start to acquire and take on. It's also potentially a warning. If you think about certain things, predominantly, they will become you. Right. They will become the majority of you. So one needs to be careful about the conversations one has, the practices one does, the things one focuses on. They're formative of the self. And this particular text is interested in the idea of self-expansion, becoming the whole of reality. So anyone who does philosophy, anyone who's interested in metaphysics, or anyone who does theoretical physics or cosmology, it says the more you think about the cosmos, the more you think about being itself, the more you become that. You expand to become that whole. More than yourself, you become something almost cosmic. And so we get to texts like this that start to analyze apart the different bits of the self, so we get a picture of how to do the work we want to do. So this is from the Aitareya Upanishad. Who is this self? That is how we venerate or think. Right? Notice that most people aren't going around in society going, who is myself? It's already an odd question. Which of these is the self? Is it that by which one sees or hears or smells, or speaks, or distinguishes between what is tasty and what is not, kind of faculty of rational judgment? Is it the heart and the mind? Is myself awareness or perception or discernment or cognition or wisdom or insight or steadfastness or thought or reflect? Look at how many words for different kinds of thought it has. Or drive or memory or intention or purpose or will, or love, or desire, which is a bit different from love. But these are all just various designations of cognition. It's an extraordinary text to me because you don't find many texts in any ancient philosophical context that divide the functions of thinking up into so many different parts and encourages you to kind of discriminate between them. Which is my desire? Or which is really love? Which is my intention that I'm going to do now? But which is my ultimate purpose? The more we can do that, what's called in Indian text discrimination, the more we start to see the differences and are able to act accordingly. So the Yoga Sutras, in a way, are the core text that pulls all of this together and gives you a sense that there is a mechanism of the self and that it has many parts, as we've seen, but we need a manual to use it well. And if you look at very early stages of the Yoga Sutras, like go into just a brush across them briefly, but the first thing it says is the thought streams, the ways that mind manifests, are fivefold. And they can be painful or not painful. They're right knowledge, inference, so reasoning, tradition, what you've been taught, genuine cognition in a sense like direct perception, wrong knowledge, so sort of false, illusory, and erroneous beliefs, imagination, different things. Yeah, imagination, pursuing concepts which are empty of substance, it says, deep sleep, and memory. We've got multiple different parts of the self here in the Yoga Sutras. But it also says that's okay because there are lots of control systems in action. The thought streams are controlled by practice, think of habit, and on the other hand, non-attachment, distancing yourself from your habits. Practice secures steadiness, you can devote yourself. Desirelessness, not giving in to desires, gives you a sense of mastery. So I could have said, no, I just don't really want a tuna sandwich. Why would I need a tuna sandwich? I'm free of that, and now I have mastery over the self. And I can use these things in a mild, or moderate, or intense way. So look, again, it's trying to like give us almost the mechanics of the different functions. I can make the self work well. Then it will have good reasoning, discrimination, a sense of bliss and well-being, and a sense of knowing who I am. Or I can work quite badly, the car runs down, in which I've got malfunctions, which include disease, inertia, doubt, lack of enthusiasm, lazy, sensuality, mere sensation is all I can think of, mind wandering, missing the point of things, instability. Right? All those are signs of a bad, malfunctioning mind machine. And I needn't go into great detail in them. Other texts also explore this. So Sankhya is an ancient school of philosophy, which also does a kind of analysis of the self, the ego, as it were, literally the sense of myself being here now, the intellect, which has to reflect and pull everything together, which uses mental effort, virtue, knowledge, non-attachment again, our power. Also the organs of sensation, the organs of action, and mind which calculates and assesses things. And if we do a good job, the intellect pulls them together, but the intellect can also pull them apart enough that it allows us to see what's underneath all of these different bits, which is the inner witness. Again, that other bird on the tree, the bit that watches ourselves and is witnesses what they're doing. That person that, you know, if you've ever been in a dream and part of you is like, is this real? This is a funny dream I'm having tonight. You can cultivate that feeling, actually. Anyone's ever done lucid dreaming, the more you notice yourself in dreams, the more you get a little bit of freedom from them, and you start to be able to control your dream. The idea is that you can do that with yourself. And Samkhya goes into all kinds of ingredients of the personality, things to watch out for. Maybe you don't want to integrate that into your machine, into your car, but perfections you can cultivate, that you can aim for, that maybe we even forget about in an everyday context. But it does say, be careful, you have to cease the dance of the personality of the self. When you wake up and you're already worried, thinking, intentions, concerns, memories, you've got to slow that dance or you'll never see the inner watcher at all. And one of the most famous and influential of Indian texts, the Bhagavad Gita, in a way pulls this together and says, if there's yoga, a kind of art of control, then there are multiple yogas. Yoga of action, acting well, behaving well, a yoga of knowledge, of correct understanding, a yoga of love, fully committing to what you really do love most, not just something you happen to have come across, and then giving yourself to it completely. Also a yoga of maya, of creativity, of making, a yoga of dharma, of ethical behavior, doing the right thing. Even ironically, in Ayurveda, so again, as I said, the science, literally the medical science of India, we see texts that tell you about the nature of the person. Here in the person are established action, its consequences, knowledge, delusion, happiness, suffering, life, death, and ownership of yourself. Right? All of that is in your own mind. He who knows this knows destruction and creation, tradition, medicine, and whatever is to be known. See what a power it is to be a student, to be the one who has ownership of all this. There cannot be anything like darkness, truth, falsehood, scripture, auspicious and inauspicious action if there is no active, aware person. And in a way, Ayurveda says that what it's really about is trying to help you access ways of becoming healthy, not only in the body, but in the mind. Even aesthetics in India, so something called rasa theory, which is a study of how to create and cultivate emotions, talks about the idea of taking control of your emotional life, which we tend to feel, classically Plato brings up this idea, we're completely controlled by emotional life. We're controlled by our emotions, we don't control them. In some cultures, that's the definition of the passions. They control us, we don't control them. But it says, just as taste, uses wonderful metaphor of cooking with spices. You can tell that this very old text, at least 1,500 years ago, they're already making curries, and this refers to recipes for lassi, so it's like putting spices into yogurt to make a tasty drink. It says, just as taste arises from the conjunction of various different spices, condiments, and substances. So you put in some turmeric, you put in some ginger, you put in some cumin, and they come together and make a new flavor. So sustained emotion, your overarching sustained mood, your emotional feeling, arises from the presentation of various factors and emotions. And they said, like your transitory feelings, the worlds that you set yourself in, your connection with other people's feelings, your ability to generalize your feelings to others, or to abstract from circumstance, or to savor the feeling you're having, all of those are tools you can use to curate your own emotional life. So it says, just as physical tastes, that of lassi, for instance, or other such drinks, are produced by substances such as brown sugar plus condiments and spices, so your emotion, in the presence of these various factors and emotions, turns into your overarching feeling. Right? So if you think of yourself as a sad person, a melancholy person, a cheerful person, a hopeful person, a vigorous person, a calm person, all of that, it wants to say, you have some control over it. You can mix those ingredients anew if you want. And Sulabha, the story of the woman in the Mahabharata who's a female yogi who has control over herself and possesses and teaches an arrogant king the true nature of the self, Even she brings this up. She says, I won't read it in detail, but even a king is a combination of the senses, sound, touch, taste, form, and scent, these and the five senses, each with their separate essence, exists in a state of combination, like lac and wood, so kind of varnish and wood. It's obvious that no one of these asks, who are you? So your sensations and your memories aren't going, oh, this is me. It's the whole person. Each has no knowledge of the others, but rather it's the whole person who brings them together. The king who brings together the nation is like the mind that brings together the parts of the self. Tantric thinkers also develop this in directions to gain powers. I've seen tantric wizards in the jungle in Thailand who are real tantric wizards just wandering around in the forest, coming out of the home, covered in spells and all kinds of things. But the kind of practices they do are linked ultimately, historically, to these practices of understanding, altering, and energizing parts of the self. So it's part of a wider set of possibilities for experimentation on the soul. So to kind of pull this together, and ultimately to close, what picture do you get at the end of this of the self? Well, in the book that I wrote before, I was interested in the way that if you look at ancient texts, you see the self as a kind of aggregation of different parts that can transform itself. It has almost we have a fluid dynamics of feeling and intention and memory and action. But we can take control of that. We can slow it and mold it. We can take apart bits of ourselves and replace them with new bits. And we do all of this with reference to the core self, who in a sense has some sort of controller or ownership over all of that. And that allows us to what I think we see here, if we look at a wider range of texts, to have a kind of mechanics of self-making, almost like a sevenfold path, though it's not necessarily one in order of, in this order, but there are different features. One is theory. You need knowledge to discriminate and separate out the different parts of the self, so and keep your personality self a little bit apart from the controlling self who reflects upon it. Right? If you're immersed in what's happening in the moment, in your personality, in your feelings, you won't have control. If you separate out the you who decides, you get more control. Analysis, so categorizing the different parts of the self, also gives a degree of control. My toe hurts and I can direct my attention to my painful toe, but I can direct it away. I can think about sad things in the past, but I can think, you know what? Think about the future. So understanding the difference gives you power. Dispassion is important because it slows the existing processes and unglues the different parts of yourself. I can't get away from my thoughts of the past if the emotion is too strong. It's like a glue. It pulls everything together and I have no freedom. But actually, I can unglue that, right? If I redirect my feeling. Don't get upset about what my mum said the other night. She's fabulous. So let it go. Put that passion back into a focus on my care for this person or whatever. There's also inner focus. So again, you can focus on certain parts of yourself, memories, features of personality that you want to have and diminish others. There's outer focus. If there's something in myself I want to have that just isn't really there, I can read a book, I can meet a person, I can get an ideal. This person becomes my model. I can imprint myself on what's outside. And that leads to visualization. I want to be more of a superhero, a brave person. I watch more Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I want to become a more a calm, kind, considerate person. I watch more, I have to think of something, I have to look for examples, right? But wherever you see heroes, in a sense, they become models that you can imprint yourself on. And practice again and again is the thing that allows you to make that stronger. You can't just do it once and then you forget about it. The bonds won't stick. You have to help put it together. So essentially, we see some areas of Indian life where people didn't really activate this kind of controlled, complex self. I won't go through them, but there are areas in which people just seem to act blandly. It's not that everyone in India was part of this yogic way of living. But we also see areas where people did have this as part of their way of thinking about emotions and arts, as their way of thinking about how to behave ethically, of how to understand yourself, and so on. And remember, students were the exemplars of this. So to draw finally on one of the first kind of big influential books on yoga, which is by Moshe Eliade, called Yoga, Immortality and Freedom, he talked about techniques for autonomy. It's not about becoming stoically quiet and calm. It's not about becoming a wizard. It's about becoming whatever you want to be. You have autonomy. He says, the danger is that you are completely at the mercy of associations. Man allows himself to be swept hither and thither by an infinity of disparate moments. Under the appearance of thought, there's really an indefinite and disordered flickering fed by sensations, words, and memories. That's your mind when it's not controlled by you. The first duty of the yogin is to think. That is, not just to let himself think, but to actively take control and think willfully of what he wants to think of through focused conscience, so that you gain a genuine will, the power freely to regulate the sort of biomental activity that is yourself. And I'm going to end on that and just give that message, I think, that India wants you to use that bird, that second bird on the tree that watches, to see who you are, to decide who you want to be, find the resources, and become the exemplary mechanic, the artist of your own self. That's India's message to you today.
Thank you for listening to the AKC podcast. If you have enjoyed this lecture, please click subscribe in your podcast app to receive future episodes. AKC, at the heart of King's thinking.